Welcome to Big Mouth, where we kick the tires of pop culture, look under the bonnet, and see whether this week's music, TV, film, and general entertainment are good runners or if they're only fit for the crusher. This week we'll be talking about how Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, 50 years old this week, created the modern album, and we'll be going to see Lush live and looking into the world of terrible light entertainment autobiographies. With me are our two special guests, both quality Dylanologists. Eamon Ford writes for The Guardian, Q and Music Ally, amongst many others. He's an expert on the business of music and he's renowned on explaining unpleasant truths about the state of the business.
I am.
Eamon's favourite bands are U2 and anything with Jack White involved. And he's...
they are.
Yes, and he's literally a doctor of pop. What does that entail, Eamon?
That entails spending 3 years on your own reading lots and lots of books and transcribing lots and lots of interviews and then hoping after 120,000 words that an external examiner will weave you through. So that's what I did for 3 years.
You're clearly not a medical doctor of pop.
No, I'm not. I've got a PhD in sociology.
Okay.
Are you allowed to take pop's temperature?
I am, yes. Just anally, though.
Okay, and that's, of course, the best way. Also with us is magazine writer James Medd of The Times, the late lamented The Word magazine, and also a seasoned obituaries writer, yes.
Indeed.
Mm. Is the world of obituaries a little bit shell-shocked at the moment? Is it the Christmas rush in obituaries at the moment?
No, it's always very steady business, yes. Obituaries.
People just keep dying.
They do.
Never
it's the one thing
imagine.
You can rely on.
And also with us, as ever, is Matt Hall, who turns the faders, pushes the knobs, and stops us from sounding too toppy or too bottomy. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Andrew.
Are we toppy or bottomy?
I think Eamon needs to...
Okay, let's get it.
We're only a few hundred feet away from Old Compton Street, so that's a very topical question.
Okay, this week we discovered that the Mercury Prize is going to be having a massive shake-up. For the first time in its 24-year history, the general public are going to get a vote on one of the nominees. So, is this going to make the Mercury Prize more relevant, more interesting, or is it going to turn it into another Boaty McBoatface? And there's only going to be 6 finalists instead of the previous 12, which is going to cut the field down drastically, and it's probably going to be bad news for token folk and token jazz, I would have thought. The judging panel, which this year includes Jarvis Cocker, the producer Naughty Boy, jazz hobbit Jamie Cullum and DJ Annie Mac, are still going to decide the winner on the night. Now, the Mercury is, of course, the award that the critics love to hate, partly because it's so hit and miss. For every Dummy by Portishead or Boy in the Corner by Dizzy Rascal, you get a clanger like M. People's Elegant Slumming, or you get a fly-by-night winner like Speech to Bell, who subsequently disappears without trace. Partly we also moan about it because we feel like it's treading on our toes, because deciding what the best album is our job. And partly because, well, it happens in September and there's not much else to moan about in September than moaning about the Mercury fills the pages. So can they fix it? What do we think? James, is allowing Joe Public to vote on the Mercury Prize going to help?
I think it's the worst thing they could have done, actually.
Yeah.
Because at least the Mercury had this sort of elitist snob, Professor of Pop, Simon Frith. And it was the critics' award, wasn't it, for the best album. There's no sale, there shouldn't be any sales ideal to it like the Brits. So it's just completely diluted it. Yeah. I can't see any point in
this. It's going to become a kind of populist thing, which it wasn't supposed to be. The Brits, while it gets loads of criticism, is about awarding the people who sold the most records or had the most streams in the previous year. So it's about blockbuster commercial success. With a token, here's a new act that a record company's thrown a load of marketing money at. Hey, we invest in new artists. But the Mercury, while people moan about it, it is this thing. It's given airtime to albums that wouldn't otherwise get it. So I think they should probably just double down and just be even more pedantic in their selections.
Yeah, I agree entirely. It's about time they really went for it. I mean, and I thought last year's winner was much too populist.
Yeah. I think they should basically disqualify anybody who's put any music on CD or MP3 or available for streaming services. It should be SoundCloud or nothing.
Yeah.
If they want to really find new music.
But isn't what they're doing, they're releasing a long list.
Yeah.
And then the public can vote for one of those.
It's the most convoluted
which
thing.
Which goes onto the shortlist, but the other four on the shortlist.
It's almost...
So you're not going to get a Belle and Sebastian. You're not going to get
it's almost
like, completely left field.
Yeah. Kind of.
But it's almost getting like the X Factor, where like 4 or 5 years ago, they just realised the format had completely run out of road. They would just put in these, oh my God, we've taken them back from the brink. It's the people we voted out, we voted back in again, and they completely changed the rules of engagement. And I think it's a bit like that. It's obviously, it's the first year with the BBC running it, so they want to do something, and it's probably hashtag engagement, get the audience involved.
Yeah. Well, also, the other danger sign on that kind of story yesterday, that when I was looking at it, is that the awards are now going to be held at the Hammersmith Apollo.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be a hotel industry wing let's ding. Drink as much as we can on what remains of record company expenses. It's going to be 2,000 people watching five bands.
Well, they had done it in the Roundhouse for the last few years, and they had bands there, but it was basically, they had like a four-way stage that was kind of concealed, and it was a bit odd because they were obviously doing the links and talking about albums while other bands were setting up, and it felt a bit odd that suddenly you would have to look right up to the ceiling because some poor schmuck had to scale a ladder to play, whereas the most famous acts were on the bottom.
Yeah, Eamon, I've been a couple of times, you've been a lot, and it always felt to me like they really were spinning it out, because ultimately there's only one award. And, you know, most award ceremonies, you've got a half a dozen gongs hanging out, an opportunity to, you know, wheel on Ronnie Wood, and, oh, look, it's Johnny Marr, and, oh, it's Rita Ora.
But what they always fail to realise is that you go to any industry award and music is absolutely at the bottom of the list. Everybody just wants to network and hang around with their mates, and they literally have no interest in music. It's like, if you go to a gig, people who don't work in the music industry, everybody standing at the back or near the bar is a journalist who works for a record label, because they're there under duress almost. And award shows are like that writ large. It's like they have no interest in the music.
But the idea that of an award show, I mean, any award show must be the most boring thing there is. To attend an award show, you are literally just sitting there.
Especially the ones for TV, because it's that whole thing about how do you project as a presenter, and that's the eternal thing with the Brit Awards. So it's like you're trying to project to the audience at home, but you're in the O2 with 20,000 people.
Yeah.
And the exact same thing affects whoever kind of pulled the short straw and presents the Mercury, because it's that weird, you're kind of falling between two stools.
Yeah. But on the Mercury Prize itself, we sort of like laugh up our sleeves at the idea of, oh, it's token folk and token jazz. But actually, often these records genuinely got a sales boost just from being nominated.
Yeah.
Was it you who wrote this piece? I was actually researching. 400%.
Yeah.
But that's from a base rate of one.
Yeah.
I suppose, if they're tiny sales. But all the same, that's career making. Yeah.
Well,
there is
an issue, because obviously it's more aimed towards the independent artists or the self-released artists, and they tend to dominate. There'll be a few big acts like Elbow or whoever who've been signed to a major. I don't know if they've changed it, but there was a huge big controversy a few years ago led by AIM, which is the trade body for independent labels, and it was really expensive to kind of put forward an album, which meant it almost became self-selective, where the big big independents like a Mute or like a Beggars or something like that were able to put acts in, but the truly small kind of industry
jazz
things,
labels, who now never send out kind of promo copies because it's so expensive. They have to put in 30 copies of a physical album,
which is ridiculous in this day and age. But also, I think if you get shortlisted, you are obliged to buy a table as well, which is like over a grand.
Well, that's the other
which
thing, isn't it?
I mean, as a small label,
isn't that
as
like journalists, the same way that they kind of flog kind of timeshare stuff. If you buy one, you're going to win a holiday.
Yeah,
then you're not.
They may have changed those rules, but that was certainly the thing a few years ago, where loads of small labels were going, it's costing us a load of money to send out all of these CDs.
Yeah.
And it was finished CDs. It wasn't even just like the promo CDs that a journalist would get, and also be obliged to take at least one table, which is a huge outlay. That's basically the entire marketing budget for a year for some labels.
If we had to fix it, what would we do? How would we fix it? Firstly, no voting for the public. Get back in your box.
Absolutely not. And also, I mean, from what I know of the judging panel has already been made too pluralistic. There are performers. There are performers on there.
Yeah.
It should be really snotty. It should be as snotty as the end of year album lists, which I love in specialist music magazines.
Yes.
I also think it should be like Logan's Run. Nobody of the age of 30 should be allowed to vote. It's got to be those people who are absolutely involved in the scene.
Okay, well, moving on from the possibly, supposedly classic albums of the last year to possibly the father of the very idea of the complete album as a complete listening experience. It's 50 years ago this week that Bob Dylan released Blonde on Blonde, the double album that completed his transformation into the poet-saint sage of cliche. It is credited with creating the notion of the album as a complete listen, but did it really? Along with the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, which also came out on the 16th of May 1966, Blonde on Blonde is seen as marking the shift from a world of pop and singles to one where albums were the key vehicle and rock music could be art. Well, is this true? Did Blonde on Blonde create the album as we know it? And how do you sell Bob Dylan to a Dylan skeptic like me who doesn't really get it? I've got two confirmed Dylan nuts with me, James Medd and Eamon Ford. Let's talk about it. James, Blonde on Blonde, did it invent the album?
It invented the rock album, I would say. Yes, definitely. I think Pet Sounds probably invented the pop album. Mm-hmm. Everyone was working towards this idea of an album because they were selling more. But they had been a collection of random songs. I mean, if you listen to Revolver, the Beatles album of that year, that's still a collection of lots of different styles of music all put together. Whereas Blonde on Blonde and Pet Sounds are unified sound. But Dylan also added in the fact that he is a genius lyricist. He's a poet. Just let's come out and just say it. So it had these levels on it as well. It's also probably the funniest record ever made.
Not something that's associated with Bob Dylan.
No, but that's Captain like Miles, is Leonard it? Cohen's the second funniest songwriter ever. So, you know.
I think you're talking about that kind of cohesion. I think that was partly down to accident, because there was kind of a border attempts in New York with what was what effectively became the band, what was the Hawks, which was his live touring band, and they just couldn't nail stuff. And then they went to Memphis. And they got in
Nashville,
and they got in like the greatest session musicians who'd never really played in that type of stuff. So that's why there's that kind of there's a feel to it.
It's funky. Yeah, what's extraordinary about it.
I think they'd also changed the layout of the studio as well. They'd taken down the partitions and stuff like that. So it was how they had to mic the studio in a very different way, where everybody was kind of playing live. And if you listen to that monumentally long box set that came out last year, The Cutting Edge, which had like everything that he recorded in 65 and 66. He was going through rapidly different versions of those songs.
Yeah.
Like, well, there's an entire disc on that collection devoted to like Rolling Stone, but there's like multiple versions of Visions of Joanna and stuff like that, and very different takes. So, and he was mixing songs up, and like the rhythm of one song in a demo would suddenly become the rhythm of a different song in the finished version and stuff. And there was like, he was changing his mind all the time.
So what's going on in his personal life at this time to sort of to drive
drugs? John Savage's fantastic book, 1966, other books about other years are available. it says that he was the first big pop star to take LSD, 1964. So he pretty much invented psychedelia. Tambourine Man. That was just the year before, when he released two unbelievably good albums as well. But then he started taking tons of speed, which you can tell if you look at the fantastic film Don't Look Back. He is off his nut on speed, and he is working constantly. And I don't know, I haven't taken that much speed, I'm glad to say so. But clearly this did something, fused things in his brain in this extraordinary way. And he is a poetic genius. He's just got married, so he's incredibly romantic. He's also obsessed with beat poetry. He's obsessed with surrealism because of LSD. All of this comes out in these incredible lyrics, which are really ambitious.
Yeah.
But he was also, in the middle of that, doing that infamous tour, was split first half acoustic to appease the folkies, second half electric with the Hawks, and being booed and slow clapped and infamously called Judas at the Manchester Free Trade Hall. So all of that stuff was going on. And also his manager had put him on this ridiculous tour as well. So the album was recorded in kind of grab moments when they were when he was basically touring the world on a really long tour while he was absolutely frazzled on drugs, while people were going, "You're a traitor to the scene and we hate you," and he's going, "I want to invent this new type of music." So he was in this massive storm of kind of contradiction and confusion. And it's kind of weird that this is, I always see Blonde on Blonde as a kind of nighttime album, and it's quite laid back, I think, as well.
Well, the reason it's a nighttime album is because it was recorded at 4 a.m.
Considering all the chaos in his life and his mental state, addled by whatever pharmaceuticals he was ingesting, you would have thought that he would have been rattling a lot more, but it wasn't.
Well, that's Highway 61 Revisited, the album before, is a speed album. It's totally mental, it's uptight, and it's New York. And then he gets taken down to Nashville. He meets these incredibly laid-back session musicians who just can play anything. They're naturally incredible musicians. They're incredibly versatile, and they just totally mellow out his thing. And anything he tries with them, they can do, which is not been his experience up in New York. He's taken two people with him, Al Cooper, the keyboard player, and Robbie Robertson, who is from the touring band. But otherwise, everyone else he's never met before, and he's totally laid back. They're all very young. He was 25. Oh. They're all about 21.
But wasn't there that story when they were doing Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, which is the very last song, and is the entire, when it was a double album, it was the entire last side, which is incredibly long, and they only ever did, I think it was one or two takes of it.
I think that's right, yeah.
And he kind of given them a rough sketch, and the session musicians were talking afterwards about saying, oh, right, okay, we were kind of building up, and after the third verse, we're going, right, okay, that's it, it's finished, and he kept going, so they were going, right, we've got to keep going, so that was, it had this natural momentum.
You can hear the sound of them going, what's going on?
Stop, and
but isn't that the thing, playing devil's advocate, just from reading various things about the album before we did the show, there's a case for saying that it's quite self-indulgent. It is the first double album.
Oh, it's massively self-indulgent, and but Dylan was at that time, but he was also firing on all cylinders.
So is it the case for saying, as with most double albums, there's a really fantastic world best ever album, single album in there?
I reckon you could do either. I mean, not like the White Album. The White Album, literally, the Beatles' White Album, you should just cut in half. But Blonde on Blonde, part of the reason it's a great album and a great rock album and becomes this idea of a rock album that people sit and obsess over and listen to in little groups around a hot, dusty gramophone and invents this new kind of listening that we get used to, is that it's sprawling and indulgent and you get lost in this world.
Although, having said that, we obviously heard Visions of Joanna, which is, for my money, not only the best song on the album, but the best song ever recorded by anybody. I think it's phenomenal. It's big talk. But it also opens with...
Switchboard's lighting up, Tom.
Let's vote on it, people.
The album opens with Rainy Day Women, which is the worst song that a human man has ever written. It's diabolical.
It's the worst song on the album.
It's a one-note joke that just immediately should have been cut off. Massively, massively awful.
You've talked about the great things that the record has done. It kind of gave us a new way of listening, gave people something to aspire to. For someone like me who's never gone into the world of Dylan, you tend to look at it and go, well, he's kind of raised up as this person who'll never be surpassed. And you get rather tired of hearing that he's the great genius. What are the bad consequences, the unintended bad consequences of Blonde on Blonde? I mean, a lot of people who aren't poets thinking that they're poets, I should imagine, is one of them.
Absolutely. Definitely the singer-songwriter movement is his fault.
Yeah.
I don't think prog rock is entirely his fault. I think Sgt. Pepper's and Pet Sounds caused that just as much. Yeah. Pink Floyd, probably his fault.
Mm-hmm. And therefore Radiohead's fault.
I think Radiohead, definitely his fault.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Probably London Calling. Probably Screamadelica.
These are all quite good things you're describing, though.
I'm trying to raise the bell curve.
Generally quite a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you're selling the notion of this Dylan circa this time, circa Blonde on Blonde, to somebody like me, to an agnostic, what are the key things you're going to tell me to make
what
me
you
run out
to?
Now? Yeah, why I should...
He's wit and wisdom. I mean, he's the funniest songwriter. He's also, as you get all the wisdom that you get from a really good film or from a really good novel or from a really good poet, you'll get all of that from him.
Yeah.
And also the music is actually really good.
Yeah.
I would also argue that if you're coming fresh to Dylan, I would listen to the singles from that period that weren't on the albums as an entry point, so possibly Four Straight and Please Crawl Out Your Window. They kind of had the pop sensibility, but they also had all of that art stuff going on as well. So I think they're a really good entry point to those albums.
You're listening to Big Mouth with me, Andrew Harrison, with Eamon Ford, who you just heard, and also James Med and Matt Hall. And we had a team night out the other night. James and Eamon and I went to see Lush at the Roundhouse, the final performance in a short comeback tour for the reformed ABBA of shoegazing. Which also included playing the Coachella Festival. Lush always stood out in the somewhat monochrome shoegazing wall of sound. They were pop, they had their punk moments, and they had the fantastic front women, Mickey Bereny and Emma Anderson. Emma wrote all the tunes. Unlike Ride, Moose, Chapter House, My Bloody Valentine, Slow Dive, Swerve Driver, Swerve Diver and Screwdriver, they were a bit of a prop proposition, and now they're back for a bit. Did we enjoy the show?
I did. I'd never seen them at the time back in the day, because I think back in the day I was living in Northern Ireland, and due to the IRA and people shooting people. Nobody came to play gigs there.
The IRA stopped shoegazing in its tracks.
They did. So, maybe,
so they weren't
maybe,
all bad. Then. Yeah.
that's a nightmare for Gerry Adams right there.
So you're pleasantly surprised.
They were really, really good. They were a lot better than I was expecting them to be.
Yeah. James, were you a shoegazing aficionado?
No, I never went to see them at the time because I thought they were terrible. I had a really good night, yeah. I thought they were really good. And what I noticed was I really liked the shoegazy ones, mm-hmm. not the sort of later Britpoppy ones. Mm. The Britpoppy ones were still quite annoying, I thought. Mm. But it did remind me, I mean, I remember going at the time in 1989 or something, going and having read about this band called Ride, back when you had to read about bands and you couldn't just listen to them immediately. And I bought this record by this band called Ride that everyone was writing about. And I thought it... To quote a famous Bob Dylan review, what is this shit? And I stick by that. But I did think My Bloody Valentine were really good. And at times, Lush, at their best, they reminded me of that.
Mm. That is why Lush, I think, are back together, isn't it? And playing the Roundhouse. Was it 2 years ago when My Bloody Valentine kind of got back together?
And well, also Ride had reformed, Slow Dive had reformed. I think there were kind of...
Wasn't this the most derided kind of movement in the last kind of 20 or 30 years, though? Why?
It's had an incredible long tail, though.
It was divisive. It was really divisive. I mean, we've got a full house of people who never saw Lush, because I was editing the Britpop magazine and the sort of pre-Britpop magazine Select at the time, and even I never went to see them. And I was really pleasantly surprised. And I think it sounded really fresh, because that sound didn't just bleed into kind of glum indie. It was a big sort of cosmic wash of noise, and it actually fed into electronics, and it fed into the Chemical Brothers, and it fed into ambient music. And even, you know, a couple of years ago you had the new gazing revival, where a whole load of like younger bands who've grown up
American bands too, weren't
they? So, and it plugs into the whole world of dream pop, where you're sort of, you know, creating these reveries. And what I really liked about it was firstly the sound was loads more muscular than I was expecting. I was expecting this kind of rather wet and dreary sort of 1991 sort of unmuscular sound, that actually was massive. It was a proper big, you know, pinges of the back wall, you know, beautiful and melodic at the same time. It wasn't just My Bloody Valentine steamrolling. It was a beautiful thing. And I was also just really impressed by the fact that it felt so different and out of kilter with now. Nothing about it was trying to tick anyone's commercial boxes in 2016. It just wanted to be itself. And I thought that was really, really delightful, actually.
Well, they did change their sound, though, didn't they, Lush? I mean, those last songs are completely...
Songs. Yeah, they're kind of
totally Britpop.
I mean, the comparisons with Elastica are not false.
Yeah, although I suppose, you know, Lush never wrote focused songs that are clearly about something the way that all the Britpop bands did. You know, the Britpop thing was the inheritor of the Kinks, where you write little vignettes and you write little bits of, it may be social commentary or it may be a portrait of an imaginary character. And Lush never quite got there.
They had that with Lady Killers, I suppose.
Yeah. It's meant to be a feminist,
kind of sleazy blokes in bars.
Their official website says rather, I don't know whether it's sniffy, it's a quote from Ivo.
Who ran 4AD.
Saying that Lush were, in fact, the only 4AD band ever to appear on Top of the Pops because of Lady Killer.
Oh, wow.
Because, no, you know, obviously they didn't trouble the charts.
Well, they did. Well, like 4AD band, like the Pixies had chart success.
Yeah, but...
They just didn't come on, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a hefty nudge in the ribs at the gig from a friend who pointed out that if a band with two women out front appeared now, and one of the women wrote all the songs, and the other one was a Morrissey figure spitting out quotes and being all, you know, being a very good figure in the press, this would be acclaimed as a massive feminist moment. It would be there would be features about it in The Guardian. There'd be a G2 front page about it.
There'd be lots of think pieces.
There'd be think pieces coming out your ears, yeah. They were quite ahead of the time, weren't they?
Yeah.
They also came across as being, at the time, I remember not liking their music, but thinking that they came across really well.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed reading about them.
They were very likeable.
God, yeah.
They also seemed to have a great life, because reading Melody Maker and the Enemy, because they kind of came from what was kind of derogatory known as the scene that celebrates itself, which kind of was the stirrings of Britpop and also shoegazing. It was like people who hung around in, what was that club in Oxford Street?
Syndrome.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of scene. But they also just seemed to be out... at gigs, being spotted out at gigs and just getting drunk and having a great time, just being young in London and being in a band, thinking this is tremendous.
It was a funny old audience, though, wasn't it? It was definitely the return of all those people that you would see clogging up the good mixer of a Friday night. It was
it's one of the part of the reason that I didn't go is it's one of my rules after after a very depressing incident in the Albert Hall a couple of years ago, watching Echo and the Bunnymen and looking at the audience and thinking, my God, is that I never go now to these kind of reunion things.
Well, I have just, a rule not to go depressing. To any reunion. Yeah, I think that, I mean, that was probably one of the least...
If the band want to do it, that's fine.
Depressing for you.
It's the audience.
Yeah, basically, that was one of the best reunions, but that's because I had no hand in this game at all. I didn't care about them before.
What you can say about the audiences for a lot of those gigs is that they're spending less on shampoo these days, but more on body wash.
Definitely. Some of them wish they spend a lot more on body wash.
They played incredibly well. I think they've like...
Well, that's
You were not a fan, and you kind of came out, perhaps not quite won over, but enjoyed yourself.
I've checked them out on Spotify.
Yeah.
I don't think you can say more than that. That's as good as it gets.
That's
the apex, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, what's the takeaway on this then? Is this the right way to do reunions? Don't attempt to sort of, you know, don't try to crowd please. Just come out and be yourself. Be yourself.
Yeah, well, just go out, play the hits. Don't be ashamed of playing the hits. I think they played one new song.
They did a little EP to kind of justify that.
Mm. But yeah, don't come back and go, here's a brand new album.
No, please. Please don't do that.
Because then you're into kind of the Verve territory or stuff like that, going, we're still relevant. And people don't care. They just want the hits.
But isn't here's one from the new album, that's code word for go to the bar really quickly.
It is. I think it's also, it's the one that the bar staff panic about. They go, my God.
Yeah, stick to the bangers. Don't bore us, get to the chorus, as Rossette so memorably said.
They did.
Should Lush make another record? Would they fit in now? Or is it good that they wouldn't fit in now?
I think what they should do is almost... I'd like another 4AD band do what the Pixies did, which was just kind of feel your way through it and then just maybe put out like an EP here and there, single here and there, just see how it goes.
I disagree. I think they should not. I don't think any reunited band should be allowed. I think once you've broken up, you can reform and play gigs, but you can't make another record.
Well, here's a case in point, though. You know, Madness split up for years and then they returned, made a not particularly great album called Wonderful, but a couple of years down the line, they then make The Liberty of Norton Folgate, which is their best album.
That could be the
absolutely incredible
record. That proves my rule, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Can you tell me of any others who've done that?
And don't say Dexys.
Well, that's a very, very moot point, isn't it? And we may be talking about it on a future show. No, it's hard to nail down people who've come back. But does that mean it's entirely impossible? I don't know. What I liked about Lush is that they managed to kind of come back as a viable thing without plugging into any kind of overt nostalgia circuit. It's not like they've gone on a gigantic package tour with Slow Dive and Chapter House and playing at Pontins for the shoegazing chalet dwellers.
There was a little moment in the gig where Mickey went, I don't have the red hair anymore, get over it, which was obviously, that was her kind of calling card for a long time. So there she was with black hair and just going, so they weren't even trying to dress up like they did.
My favourite that Emma's Wikipedia entry, which may or may not have been written by someone close to her, has the best payoff line of any Wikipedia biog in the ever. She lives in Hastings. She is agnostic.
And you're listening to Big Mouth with me, Andrew Harrison, and our guests, James Medd and Eamon Ford, whose key interests include the terrible celebrity biography, the awful book written by the mid-range semi-celebrity, justifying their world and doing a full Alan Partridge. What is this, Eamon, that you get out of reading these terrible books?
They're wonderfully, wonderfully deluded. It's people whose career generally have gone south many, many years before, and they're craving for the glory days, and but they're still so bitter that life has moved on, that the era of the three TV channels has made them moribund, and they're really bitter about the entire thing, and they also want to settle scores. It's like Alan Partridge's line about, needless to say, I had the last laugh. they want to do that, but it's just, they're kind of tied up in a knot of irrelevance and bitterness. It's wonderful.
Well, you've done a bit of show and tell here. You've brought in some favourites. Well, what have we got here?
Right, well, I'll do an excerpt from three different books. The first one is Poptastic by Tony Blackburn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful book. I've probably broken every copyright law in the world by taking pictures of excerpts and putting it up on Storify. So right. If you Google my name, Storify and Tony Blackburn, you will get the entire book, because I was reading it just going, this is phenomenal. This is really early on in the book where he's talking about John F. Kennedy and the influence that he had on culture. So he goes, John F. Kennedy epitomised many of the good things about America. He was young, dynamic and determined to make positive changes. And then some idiot shot him. I mean, what a stupid thing to do. It goes on and on like this.
Perspective.
It's wonderful. I also read back to back, what was the exact title? Because he's done two autobiographies. I did Little Goes a Long Way by Sid Little. And then I also did Larger Than Life by Eddie Large back to back.
You'd have to, wouldn't you?
Sid's is really boring because there's one bit where he's in a dressing room in 1965 and Paul McCartney comes in and plays them Yesterday because they're on some variety bill at the same time. And he manages to turn one of the kind of the driving forces of popular culture at that very moment, at the absolute apex of his power, turn that into the most boring anecdote. But then he finds God, so the second half is about him finding God. Eddie, on the other hand, is not happy about him finding God. And also his wife, Cherie, actually threatened our relationship because me, Dave, which was Sid's brother, and Sid were just three lads together chatting up girls, doing the dirty jokes and generally having a laugh. Then all of a sudden, Yoko's there.
Cherie is Yoko.
Yeah. We used to come back from the matinee on a Saturday afternoon desperate to watch the football results and Cherie would be sitting there watching the Thornbirds or a film. The bitterness. But then he talks about where's the bit about, yes, so he goes on about born again Christians. He says where Sid and I really differ is over religion. When it comes to the born again showbiz Christians, it doesn't sit well with me because I doubt their motives. The born agains in our business usually have a career that has gone belly up, owe a load of money, or as in Sid's case, have a guilt complex about something, so they turn to religion. It's not like Eddie's career's gone belly up. But the absolute the most terrifying book you will ever read, and it's really, really hard to get now, is Fan Dabby Dozy. Our Amazing True Story, which is, you may have guessed, is the autobiography of Ian and Jeanette. It's Jimmy Cranky, with a foreword by Max Bygraves. But it's written as a kind of a two-way autobiography, where they write, they have kind of chunks where Ian will talk about something, and then Jeanette will talk about something. They talk about going to swinging parties, and it's all very, very dirty and grubby and horrible stuff.
Never look at the crackies in the same way again.
But there's a running motif about how much they hate Paul Daniels all the way through. It's fantastic. They just won't let it go. So there's one bit where they were on some package tour together and they were in a hotel and Paul Daniels was there and he kept showing up and doing tricks and Jeanette said he came over to our table but into our conversation as usual and that's when Ian told him to piss off. So Ian picked up the story when something just snapped and I swung for him. I didn't hit him that badly but he went flying off the bar stool onto his arse. I simply cracked, but amazingly a punch in the gob had no effect whatsoever on Paul. And then he talked about going out with they ended up on another package tour with 70 magicians who were doing the exact same thing, and he said the unfortunate thing was that I couldn't take a swing at all of them, and it's full of stuff like that. Then there's
maybe he just doesn't like magicians.
Yeah,
maybe the magician did something terrible in the past somewhere. Yeah,
there might be. But there's an amazing thing where they go on tour in Turkey in the early days with a chimpanzee that gets the trots, which is just phenomenal. Again, go to Storify, search my name, the Crankies.
Are there any decent star autobiographies?
I like the bitter ones of the people trying to settle scores because that's funny. But like some of them are just really boring. Because I read my near namesake Eamon Holmes' autobiography, and it's just it's deathly dull. There's like nothing in there whatsoever.
That is the case with pretty much all celebrity books, though, isn't it? Because, you know, they're sold on the name, and footballer books are the worst for this, aren't they? You know, just immense tedium because they haven't really got any opinions, and the stuff that they go through that matters, they won't take a position on because they don't want to scotch any particular, potential future work.
So, do you have to be A, dead, or B, written about by somebody else to make it? A decent life story, because there's that Tiny Tim one which I haven't read yet, which has come out, or is coming out, apparently is amazing, quite a peripheral character, but apparently...
There is always exceptions to the rule. I've just read Moby's autobiography, which actually was pretty good, I thought, because he has a...
But he's an erudite guy.
Yeah, he's got a gift, and also he has a kind of...
Are you saying that Jimmy Cranky's not an erudite guy?
He's not. He's not even a guy.
No!
What?
Spoiler alert!
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's now employed as Tyrion Lannister in Game of Thrones.
I thought he was employed in AC/DC as a guitarist.
He is.
He's everywhere.
I suddenly realised when this came up that a few years ago for a certain magazine that we all worked for, I reviewed 12 of these comedians' autobiographies which was possibly one of the most depressing weeks of my life.
You read 12 books in a week. That's brilliant.
Well, read. But the worst I've read, and I've read the Tony Blackburn one, the worst was Dom Jolly's. Because really? What Dom Jolly does is he invents half of it. With hilarious escapades about being on drugs and going up the Eiffel Tower on LSD and having sex with Peter Mandelson. And it's the most unfunny and awful book I have ever read.
On a similar theme, but somebody who actually does it really well is Richard Ayoade's supposed memoir slash autobiography,
which is made where
he's
words,
like he's like kind of taken a very art postmodern deconstruction of the whole thing, and it's really really good, and it's and also it's laugh out loud funny. So
yeah, that's what Don was going for.
Yeah,
you can't really blame. I'm gonna see if this stands. You can't really blame the star though, can you?
No, because they're getting a final payday.
It's a case of the, and it's also the case of the publishing industry being desperate to be able to sell books.
Well, they know the ghostwriter as much.
Yeah,
the ghostwriter. You know, we've all done
been hacks.
We're all
pay the rent. Yes.
Yeah, you do that, but there's a certain way where you do someone, you know, in their own words, stories like that. Mm. And most of them are done really badly.
Mm. Have you read, and this is also worth tracking down, Pete Waterman's autobiography, I Wish I Was Me. It's phenomenal because in it he invents disco, he invents sampling, he invents hip-hop.
It's all true.
He invents Meedam, then he has which is like a music industry conference. Then he bangs on about, he's a chapter about trains, and then he's another chapter about Thatcher. It's utterly deranged.
I once did an interview for radio where when Quincy Jones's Back on the Block album came out, and he came over and he had a big fit. There was a film, and I got Pete Waterman to interview him. We sat them down together, and Pete Waterman spent the whole of the allotted time telling Quincy Jones about all the stuff that he'd invented.
He's amazing.
Including Michael Jackson, because he found Rod Temperton.
I once found myself stuck next to Pete Waterman at a business dinner, and he was fantastically entertaining. He gave me a monologue on what Radiohead would have been wrong in their career and how he would fix Radiohead's career. What he'd get Radiohead doing to make them better. Less boring, less bloody miserable. Get some entertainment out. Pop music's for the kids. What's the matter with you? Nobody wants to hear you whine.
Maybe Sonya was definitely better.
Yeah, well, he's not wrong. I would love to hear Radiohead do a PWL thing.
Well, there was a weird PWL moment when they were getting signed up by everybody. Didn't they produce Judas Priest at one point?
Yeah.
It may not have come out, but they did produce Judas Priest. Yeah. And it wasn't all things like Dead or Alive, where a kind of vaguely cred band goes for the, like, reaches for the brass ring of pop. It was often genuinely bizarre people. PWL versus Radiohead.
I'd be up for it.
I would definitely want to hear that.
So, we want to find these things. Are they all on Kindle? Can you pick them up for like 50p?
Unfortunately not. Most of them have kind of had a limited shelf life.
I bet you there's a book barn somewhere near you.
Every now and again, somebody will find the Storify link for the Cranky's autobiography. Go, my God, you can't unsee this. And I'll be copied in on Twitter. And you look at it and, like, 10,000 people have read it, something ridiculous. And then somebody went, I went to Amazon to try and buy that book, and it was going for, like, £300 because there's, like, hardly any copies left. And I think it was partly, maybe I drove up the demand
maybe
for that.
Maybe you did. You should have bought it all up before.
But then, like, you've no need to buy it because, as I say, I've infringed every intellectual property law going.
And then gone onto a podcast and talked about it.
Exactly.
Pretty much everything.
It's all right. They've still got Panto, haven't they?
Yeah. I think it's allowed under we're reviewing. It's critical. Critical defence, my lord. Okay, we're coming to the end of the show, and as ever, we're going to ask our guests for their closing time chatter, the thing that's caught their imagination this week and that they really want to pass on. James, I believe you have a thing for Louis C.K.'s new show. Tell us about it.
I do have a thing. It's a strange thing, though, because I could, for Louis C.K.'s, the American comedian's last show, his sitcom, Louis, L-O-U-I-E, unlike him with an S, I could just tell you it's brilliant, it's hilarious, it's wise, it's all these things.
It's also but very dark.
It's quite dark, but you ain't seen nothing yet.
Okay.
Horace and Pete's, which is the name of the bar in which this new show is set, which is exclusively so far, I think, available download from his own website, is no comedy at all. It's just tragedy. And it's got all the hilarious comedy staples of cancer, mental illness, child abuse, alcoholism, divorce, parental estrangement. It's also got a all-star cast, Steve Buscemi, Louis himself, Edie Carmela Soprano, Falco, Alan Alda, Jessica Lange.
And Stephen Wright.
And Stephen Wright, absolutely right. And it's really theatre, which I wouldn't normally promote, I have to admit. But it has made me obsessed.
So when you say there's no comedy at all, tragic, it's not kind of tragic comic in the sense of...
this is not dark comedy. This is just dark.
But there are funny bits.
All right, but it's definitely tipped over from being black comedy to just black.
Okay, well, should we have a listen to a bit? Here's where Louis's daughter, Alice, meets the bar regular, Marcia.
Hi, Marcia. Is that Alice?
Yeah, hi.
Oh. Are you here to see your daddy?
Yep.
Kiss.
No, thank you.
Oh, you don't want to kiss your grandma?
Well, you're not my grandma. You were my dad's last girlfriend, so...
Well, that never stopped you before. I mean, you always used to kiss me.
Yeah, I think that was before I figured out that I don't have to, so... I never really liked it.
Wow. That's really mean. That's really mean, Alice. I didn't think you could be mean.
Sorry, Marcia, I'm not trying to be mean.
You should try it sometime. You have an aptitude.
That's Louis C.K.'s new show, which is called Horace and Pete's. And you can get it on the internet, on the famous internet.
You talked about doing self-release and stuff and dark and miserable. Is he the Radiohead of comedy?
I guess he must be.
Eamon, your obsession at the moment is...
I've got to talk about a memoir which is actually really good. It's Sylvia Patterson's memoir. Sylvia Patterson was a kind of key writer in smash hits from the 80s and is one of the most wonderful writers and interviewers, because she will just ask really awful questions of people, not in a malicious way, but just get really good responses out of it. Her memoirs are coming out, I think, in the next couple of weeks, and it's called I'm Not With The Band. And there's a kind of narrative arc, which is her joining smash hits in a kind of an era of innocence, where you're kind of going, hey, it's all just a big game and we're going to get you publicity and it's going to be a right old chortle, to the point where it's into kind of clickbait and stuff like that. So it's like it's kind of her career in pop is also a kind of qualitative decline in the type of writing that people want, which is the huge influence of the PR, but then also stuff being taken out of context and Twitter wars and stuff like that. So she uses kind of key interviews through her career to kind of tell this story. But that sounds quite serious, but in among all is really, really hilarious stuff about... There's a brilliant anecdote about going on tour with New Order and groupies in the mid-80s, which is very, very funny. And also kind of heartbreaking stuff, where she brings in little elements of her personal life as well, where she was actually born without skin. And she was in like an incubator for the first 6 months of her life or something like that. She had some really weird dermatological condition.
She's grown a pretty thick one since then.
Well, exactly. And then she's kind of got stuff in her private life where she talks about having multiple miscarriages and stuff like that. So in among all of this kind of, it's a jolly wheeze, the music industry. And like her mother was a functional alcoholic, and it's this strained relationship she has with her parents and stuff like that. So that's kind of gone all the way through it. But it's an incredibly wise book as well. There's a lot of kind of self-reflexivity, which in those rubbish memoirs I was talking about is what they desperately lack. And she's completely aware of what her limitations are, and she's also aware of what her greatness is. There's an amazing letter that she sent to the features editor of The Enemy when she was resigning from The Enemy, which she never actually sent, but then she's republished in the book, and it's about 4 pages long, and it's the most incredible takedown of everything that she sees going wrong with the magazine and why she's ashamed to be associated with it. And it's amazing. You have to read it. It's just, it takes no prisoners.
Can you do us all a favour and stick it on Storyfy?
I can, yes.
Actually,
it's phenomenally good. It's one of those ones where you're kind of given a standing ovation and you're only a third of the way through, and then it just gets to the end and you just go, my God, I would love to be able to write an email like that.
Well, we've got Sylve coming on the show in a couple of weeks' time, and she's a fantastic writer and hilariously funny, and it does sounds like an amazing read.
It's really, really good book.
My own closing time chatter is, we're coming to the end of the football season, how I'm going to get through the next, I don't know, what is it, fortnight without any football before the Euros start. Well, I heard a fascinating thing from friend of the show, Edie Mullen. Her dad, Chris, has discovered that you can watch football via, you can illegally watch streaming football via YouTube on your telly if you've got an Apple TV. If you're prepared to scroll through pages and pages of YouTube results, you can find some Arab channel or some Kazakhstani channel might be streaming live the latest Premier League game. He discovered that there were flaws in this, however, when he was watching Leicester versus Chelsea the other day, and it looked, you know, it was terribly exciting. And when the score approached 5-2, he started to get a little bit suspicious about it, and then realised that for 20 minutes he'd been watching live FIFA 16 gameplay from the video game, thinking it was the real game. So, you know, the stuff is out there, and we're in no way endorsing it, of course. It would be totally illegal, but just be careful. If the players look a bit blocky, if everything looks a bit made of Lego, then you may actually not be watching the game at all.
Yeah, FA Cup in Minecraft.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would totally watch that. FA Cup in Minecraft.
I would watch that, and I hate football.
Well, there we go. Time's up. That's our show. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks again to our guests James Med and Eamon Ford. Remember, you can hear the show again and download it as a podcast at audioboom.com. Just search for Big Mouth. This show and all our past podcasts will be on there too. If you're an iTunes kind of person, you can subscribe via the iTunes store. Just go into the podcasts section on iTunes and again search for Big Mouth. And of course, we'll see you again next week, bright and early, with bacon and egg, fried bread and black pudding at 9 o'clock in the morning on SohoRadio.com. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.